This is your Professor Debbie. Welcome to True Crime University, where we have intellectual discussions about crime. This is a class for mature audiences with mature language and subject matter. I have a PhD in criminal justice and 17 years experience in the law enforcement field, and I am happy to share my knowledge with you. Hello, class. How's everybody tonight? It's ready for part two of Claire and David Harris. I'm shaking my drink, my prime hydration drink, lemonade. Nobody cares. So when we left off last time, it was Wednesday, July 24th, 2002. Clara was on edge the whole day because she knew David was supposed to meet with Gail and break things off. And we know she had already hired Blue Moon Detective Agency to follow him, but Clara thought of everything. She had also enlisted the help of another spy. Remember Susan, the office manager? She followed David when he left the office. She knew he was supposed to meet with Gail at this restaurant, and actually the whole office knew. So she calls Clara and says, "He's not going to the restaurant. I don't know where he's going." Clara expresses that she wants to go find him. And Susan says, "Do you want to see if he's at Gail's house?" And Clara's like, "I don't know where she lives." Susan said, "I do." And Clara's like, "How do you know?" Susan said, "Well, me and some of the girls followed him there one night." So this has become like a game to everybody in the office, which is actually kind of disturbing, to be honest. Clara and Lindsay get into Clara's Mercedes and go to the parking lot of Perry's restaurant. That's where he was originally supposed to be. But they don't see either David or Gail's cars. Remember, Clara had signed a contract with Blue Moon, promising not to interfere in the investigation. She's interfering. Lindsay recalled that Clara was upset and crying. Then they went to Gail's house, which Susan had given them the address of, and they weren't there either. Then they went to another restaurant, Tommy's Patio Cafe, one of David's favorites. They weren't there either. So Clara called Blue Moon's after-hours number and left a message. At this point, Lindsay was driving the car because Clara was too upset. And at one point, she tried to calm herself down with a plastic glass of wine. They go to the Kema Aquarium. Absolutely no idea why. Maybe there's a restaurant there. But it sounds like a cool place to go anyway. And they're not there either. Lindsay said that they were going to forget it and go shopping. But unfortunately for everybody involved, somebody from Blue Moon returned Clara's call. Why I said that this is unfortunate for everybody will become clear very soon. The man on the phone, who turned out to be the firm's owner, told her that the investigator tailing David and Gail had called in and said that they were at the Nassau Bay Hilton. This is important, quote, on the fourth or sixth floor. How he would have known what floor they were on is anybody's guess. The only thing I can think of is that the person who was a woman investigator actually went into the lobby, saw them get on the elevator, and then watched the, you know how the there's like numbers over the elevator that tells you what floor it's on, and that she saw that somebody got off on the fourth floor and the sixth floor. That's the absolute only thing I can think of. But the owner on the phone did tell Clara to stay home and wait for their report the next day. Lindsay later said that at this point she could see a change in Clara. It was like she became a different person. She called their nanny, Maria, and told her to pack David's best clothes in a suitcase and put it in the garage and to throw the rest of his clothes in the garbage. Poor Maria must have been like, "What the fuck? This is not in my job description." Clara told Lindsay to go to the Hilton, which she did, and the two of them went into the lobby and to the front desk. In the meantime, We're going to switch scenes. We find out later that afternoon, Gail had met David at the hotel as he directed her. They sat in the lobby, and David apologized to her for his wife's behavior the other day when she'd fired Gail. Gail also said, and this was later confirmed, that Clara had been leaving threatening messages on her answering machine, and she was now actually afraid of her. Gail was afraid of Clara. After a while, according to Gail, they agreed to leave, and David walked her outside to her Lincoln Navigator. But they weren't done talking. They got in it and continued talking. So it's July in Texas, and soon they're hot as fuck. Gail turns the air conditioner on, but David said, let's go back in the hotel. Gail said that David convinced her to get a room and got the key to room 604. So the PI was right. They did have a room on the sixth floor. In the room, she said, they continued talking until David's cell phone rang. So back to Clara and Lindsay. They asked the desk clerk, Garrett Clark, this is the same dude who'd been there yesterday, remember, what room David Harris was in. He looked and he said there's nobody by that name registered. Then she tried Gail's name. No dice. Actually, as it was later learned, the clerk simply hadn't bothered to ask for David's ID when he paid for the room in cash. So David and Gail weren't being deceptive. Clara and Lindsay went back outside and walked around the parking lot looking for either David or Gail's car. They quickly found Gail's black Navigator. So Clara, in a rage, runs at it and starts vandalizing it. She ripped off the front and back windshield wipers and scratched the doors with a key. If you look in my social media, there are pictures of this. And because her car was black, these scratches show up very clearly. Then Clara and Lindsay devised a plan to lure David out of the hotel. They'd call him and say that he had to get home because one of the kids was sick. Remember, one of them had asthma, so this was believable. Lindsay called her dad's cell phone and told him that her brother was sick and he needed to come home. Clara and Lindsay made their way inside the hotel to accost David when he got off the elevator. Apparently, he wasn't moving fast enough, so Clara called him again, screaming so loud at him to get home that Gail could hear her. David said he was coming. What happens next, there are several different versions of. You know how if 20 people witness an event, there's 20 different versions of it. So I'm going to put everything together as neatly as possible according to the various testimonies. The elevator door opens and David and Gail step out hand in hand. Clara and Lindsay are standing there and Clara absolutely loses her shit. She lunged out at Gail, hitting her and tearing her shirt off. Gail ended up on the marble floor with Clara on top of her, and David was trying in vain to pull Clara off of Gail. One witness said, quote, the wife was hitting the girlfriend, ripped her shirt off. The wife was screaming, you know you're with my husband. Somebody else said that what Clara actually screamed was, quote, you bitch, that's my husband. Then, loudly announced to all of the bystanders, quote, this is Dr. David Harris, and he's fucking this woman right here, end quote. Another witness said, quote, every time they pulled her apart, Clara, she'd kind of go at her again. While all this was happening, this teenage girl was actually hitting the dad with her purse. She was screaming, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, end quote. Clara later told Oprah, when Oprah asked her what she thought when she saw them get off the elevator, quote, at that moment, the description of what I felt is just so impossible. It was a complete disconnection between my mind, I stopped thinking, and my actions. I remember Lindsay had me by the arm, and she said, oh, Mom, don't go there, end quote. She also said that there was, quote, nothing in her mind. While all this was going on, somebody at the desk called 911, so the police were already on their way by the time the melee moved outside. The desk clerk, Garrett, said that he helped Gail collect her stuff and that, quote, her blouse was off, she was scared for her life, and she was shaking, end quote. So somebody from the hotel escorted David and Gail outside. I think it was Garrett. And somebody else escorted Clara and Lindsay out. Now we're going to get a wide variety of versions of what happened next. It was about 8:30 p.m., just starting to turn dark. David walked Gail to her navigator, which was now vandalized. We don't know if he planned to leave with her, probably considering what had just happened, but that's irrelevant now. Remember, there were at least a couple hotel employees out here because they'd escorted everybody to their cars, and they'll be witnesses later. When you listen to witnesses testify, you have to kind of judge them on their credibility, like who's believable, who's not, for various reasons. Did they say they heard or saw something when it seems like they were too far away to see or hear what they thought they did? Not to say people are lying, but in the heat of the moment, when stuff just happens real fast, especially during something traumatic, your memory may be impaired. Clara and Lindsay got into Clara's Mercedes, Clara at the wheel. Everybody agrees that they heard the sound of tires squealing as Clara backed out of her parking space, raced around the parking lot, and aimed her car straight for David and Gail, who were standing next to each other beside Gail's car. A hotel employee saw the car coming at them and tried to stop Clara, banging on her hood as the car passed him. Remember that, because it's going to be important. Clara rammed her car into the back of Gail's navigator, then backed up. Lindsay later said that she saw David's eyes widen in fear, and he held up his hand as if to stop Clara. Remember, this poor girl is in the passenger seat this whole time. Witnesses said that Clara accelerated, then ran into David, throwing him 25 feet across the parking lot and landing near a curb. According to Garrett, the desk clerk, quote, I saw the Mercedes hit David Harris, then come to a complete stop. She proceeded to drive over the first median, then across the parking lot, then in circles, end quote. He claimed that she drove over David three times, and somebody else claimed it was five times. Garrett testified that he heard Clara, quote, laughing or cackling as she hit David, and that he heard Lindsay inside the car crying and begging her to stop. A witness named Oscar, who had been playing tennis across the street. And it says across the street, but if you look at the picture I have of the, it's a Google map, like aerial view of the hotel. I think it's in last week's pictures. I wouldn't call it across the street. There's kind of like an alley. There's the parking lot, and then there's like a small dirt road. And then there's a bunch of tennis courts, and that has to be the tennis courts he's referring to. Well, anyway, he said in court that his tennis game had been interrupted by screams and screeching tires. He said he saw a man's body flying and saw a car run over him three times, making three complete circles in the parking lot before stopping. He said he remembered a teenage girl jumping out and screaming, quote, my dad, you've killed my dad. He's dead, end quote. He also said that David was, quote, mauled and gasping for air, end quote. So I am definitely not implying that this dude is lying or didn't see this or making it up. But that last part, David was mauled and gasping for air. There's no way, I mean, at least in my opinion, from what I saw, he could have seen this from the tennis courts. So it's possible that him and the guy that he was playing tennis with left the tennis court and ran over to the parking lot to observe this. Lindsay later said that David, quote, was really scared because he was trying to get away and couldn't, end quote. She recalled that he reached his hand out and touched the hood of Claire's car, leaving fingerprints. She said that Claire had no expression. Lindsay testified, quote, I felt the bump. I knew it was him, and I said, you're killing him, end quote. She recalled that when the car stopped, she ran around to Claire's window and reached in and hit her in the face. So, to me, personally, the most reliable witness, I'll tell you why in a minute, was somebody I saw on an episode of American Justice. This was a woman named Julie, who, with her fiancé Robert, was on vacation at the hotel, and they were at the hotel pool when this happened. She said they heard a shrill scream and a commotion from the parking lot, which was adjacent to the pool. And somebody yelled, quote, he's been hit. So Julie and Robert rush over to see if they can help. She said, quote, there was a man laying on his back, and there was a woman knelt over him, and she had his head cradled in her hands, and she was shaking him, and she was saying, David, look what you made me do. And the first thing that I knew was that anyone who's been lying injured cannot be moved. And I hit her in the front of the chest and knocked her back and said, you can't move him, end quote. She said David's teeth came out in her hand. Lindsay was, quote, hysterically screaming and crying. And Robert told David, quote, David, your daughter's watching. You can't die here. You got to fight to stay alive, end quote. They'd obviously figured out who Lindsay was. So why I believe Julie is, well, for one thing, she doesn't have any, what's the phrase, interest in this. She's a total bystander. They were there at the pool, and this happened. When she quoted Clara, that she said to David, David, look what you made me do. She said it just like that. And Clara has a very heavy Colombian accent, and Julie absolutely nailed it, probably a lot better than I did. So that made me think, in order for her to imitate her accent that well, she must have really been there and Claire must have actually said that. So the rest of what Julie said must be true. Or if I was a juror, I would give her a lot of credibility. Now, Clara, as a medical professional, would certainly know not to hold David's head and shake it. But she wasn't acting logically here, and David was beyond help by this point. Just a real short lesson on if you ever come across somebody who's hurt, they're like this guy was. He was laying on his back. If you didn't know that a car had run over him and you didn't know what was wrong with him, you should always assume that somebody has a head or neck injury. That's what they teach us in EMT school. So if somebody's hurt, like they fall, or if there's any chance at all they hit their head or neck or back, don't move them. What you should do if you can is hold their neck, like kind of cradle it in place. It's called holding C-spine, but that's the technical term. But yeah, don't ever move anybody with a possible head, neck, or back injury. Nassau Bay Police Lieutenant Joe Casciola came to the scene, and he later said, quote, I saw the daughter lying on the ground, crying uncontrollably and sobbing. She had to watch her dad, 5 feet from her, underneath the car, while they're putting her mom in handcuffs. It was obviously a horrible situation, end quote. Detective Teresa Relkin arrived and noted the state of the parking lot, the battered Mercedes, the bloodstained pavement, the broken windshield wiper on Gail's vehicle, and David's toupee on the ground. By this time, David had been taken away by ambulance. Somebody said that as she was being led away by police, Claire called out to him, quote, I'm sorry, David, I love you, end quote. Gail called David's parents and put Lindsay on the phone. Lindsay told them, there has been an accident, come quick. Then Julie Knight took Gail to the ER. I don't know where Julie came from. Gail must have called her. As the police were taking witness statements it was obvious that people had seen and heard different things. Witnesses said that David had been run over by Clara anywhere between 1 and 5 times. Some said that she'd stopped the car, then backed up and rolled over him. Lindsay said, quote, "I felt so bad that I couldn't help him. I felt so mad that I couldn't do anything. It was terrifying. I knew that she was killing him. I knew that he wasn't going to be okay. I was only given 16 and a half years to spend with him. I knew that I wouldn't have any more than that. It was a terrible way for a person to go," end quote. And yeah, if you think about various, he didn't die, but right away, by the way, I don't know how long he lingered for. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But the various ways that you can die, this has to be one of the worst. When I tell you about his autopsy results, you'll see just how battered his entire body was. And for his child to have witnessed that is unbelievably horrific for her. We have a thunderstorm here, so if you hear thunder, it's not a sound effect, it's the real thing outside. Now, Claire told the police that it was an accident, and the officer who drove her to the police station said that she, quote, looked like she was in shock. Meanwhile, at Christus St. John Hospital, according to the hospital, David arrived by ambulance at 9:34 p.m. and was pronounced dead at 9:48. His parents, Gerald and Millie, walked into the ER to find him laying on a bed, still hooked up to IVs, intubated, etc. I could only imagine coming in to see your son basically crushed, bloody, and lifeless. Back to the crime scene. I know I'm jumping around, but all this stuff is happening at the same time. Remember, Clara had hired an investigator to follow and record David and Gail? Well, the investigator, her name was Lindsay, not to be confused with the stepdaughter, was in her car somewhere across from the hotel while all this was going on. And by looking at the overhead Google Map picture, I can't figure out where she was. Also, this was over 20 years ago, so this area could have changed. Lindsay, the investigator, had ascertained that David and Gail were in the hotel and was waiting till they came out to get photo and video evidence. She said she was shocked when, at exactly 8:43 p.m., she heard tires squealing and yelling in the parking lot of the hotel. How do we know it was exactly 8:43? Because it's time-stamped on the video. As soon as Lindsay heard the tires, she pointed her video camera at the parking lot and started filming. The film was used in the trial. There's actually very little to see. She was pretty far away. It was just turning dark, and there's a lot of cars in the parking lot. Clara's car is silver, so it does show up, but all you can really see is the car making a couple circles. And I have the one frame of this in my social media. So Lindsay's freaked out. She wasn't expecting this. She called her boss at Blue Moon and asked what to do, and they said cooperate with the police. Imagine how happy the cops were when this girl comes over and hands them a tape and says, "I got it all on tape." So they're all excited. Then they saw the tape and how little is actually on there, and they were probably less excited. Clara was at the Nassau Bay Police Station where, according to police, she made an incoherent, rambling statement in which she claimed she had hit David by accident. She was then taken to the Harris County Jail, where she was charged with murder, and 2 days later released on $30,000 bail. She was given bail because she was a first-time offender and not considered a flight risk. So while Clara was being questioned, David's body was taken to the Texas Medical Center for an autopsy. Trigger warning, this is going to be graphic. Apparently, his body was in worse condition than most of the murder victims autopsied by Dr. Dwayne Wolfe. He still had his trach tube in place, cervical collar still on, EKG pads still on his chest, and a chest tube in place in his lung. The first thing Dr. Wolfe noted was that David had lost part of his toupee, as evidenced by the scars on his head, which suggested an expensive hair transplant. He had suffered severe trauma to the upper body. His chest was crushed from the impact. His head was a mess with a 3x4-inch zone of contusions around his ears. There was damage to his chin, deep cuts on his scalp, and a large gash on the back of his neck. His jaw was broken and his teeth missing. He had 16 separate cuts and abrasions on his head and neck. He had 5 cuts and abrasions on his back. His ribs were broken in the front and back, and his left lung had been destroyed with 10 broken ribs. A piece of his heart was severed, and his 12th vertebra and pelvis were broken, and both of his arms had multiple cuts and abrasions. His legs were, quote, a mass of gaping wounds and red meat, end quote. He'd also bitten his tongue. While this was going on, Lindsay Harris was taken home by her uncle, dentist Robert Blanchard. I don't know if he was actually an uncle or one of those, you know how you have a close family friend and you call them, you know, Uncle Bob or whatever. And just as an aside, he was the person who ended up taking over the practice while Clara was in prison. When she got home, she was met by her dad's suitcase full of clothes in the garage, the one Clara had told Maria to pack. And she later said that she unpacked all his stuff and laid it out on her bed just to feel close to him, which is heartbreaking. The house started filling with people, relatives, and friends to help Lindsay and her brothers, who were 3 at the time. After being treated in the hospital for her wounds, remember, Clara had beat the shit out of her, Gail was taken to her home, where, unfortunately, she was hounded by the media. News of David's murder had spread fast. People were fascinated by the sensational aspects of this case. They were professionals, dentists, rich. There was a mistress, secret trysts in a hotel. The newspapers had a field day with lurid and ridiculous headlines. One referred to Clara as the driller killer, insert eye roll. And one headline was mad wife at wheel. The murder became fodder for late night comedy. Everybody in Texas was talking about this case. The papers were filled with letters to the editor in which Texans made their opinions known. Many, if not most, of the people took Clara's side. One person blamed everything on Gail, and lots of other people blamed David. Just as an example of how passionate, I guess the word is, people were about this, I wanted to read you one that I found online. And I'm not saying I agree with this person. I just found this letter by somebody who kind of knew them. Well, you'll see. It's emotional. It's well-written. And it just seems to me to kind of sum up the feelings of a lot of people, according to what I found anyway. And he said that Clara was his wife's dentist, and he had met David several times. And his letter says, quote, "It may be technically wrong to take this attitude since we live under the rule of law and Clara did technically murder her husband, but as in cases of self-defense, there were significant mitigating circumstances. He committed some of the most egregious acts in the catalog of human relationships." He has them numbered. 1. He cheated on his wife, with whom he shared not only a marriage, but a large professional practice and 3 children who loved them both. 2. He lied to his receptionist in order to seduce her. This in no way relieves her of blame, telling her that he and Clara had an open marriage. 3. He had a sexual relationship with a person who worked for him which breaks one of the cardinal rules of professional conduct. Even if he had been single, this is one of the biggest no-nos in office ethics. Never, ever have a romantic relationship with someone you work with, especially someone who works for you. It is ruinous to your career and creates a set of circumstances that destroy your credibility and trust among your colleagues and subordinates. 4. It made his trusting wife into the subject of office gossip, derision, scorn, and pity. 5. He ruined his own personal reputation among friends and professional colleagues. If I had been on her jury, there is no way she would have been convicted. He attacked her in a way that injured her so seriously that it almost killed her. She could hardly be blamed for defending herself from him. The harm he caused her by his repeated, purposeful betrayals was as harmful to her as if he had attacked her with a gun or knife. She repeatedly forgave him and even allowed him to have one last meeting with his mistress to explain that their relationship was over, and he once again betrayed his long-suffering wife by having one more fling with his mistress. Not only that, which was bad enough, he had this fling with his mistress in the very hotel where he and Clara were married. This loathsome cretin more than deserved his wife's fiery wrath. There isn't one among us who can truthfully claim that they would not be tempted to do the same thing she did. If you claim otherwise, you're lying to yourself. End quote. Wow, that's what you call a strong opinion. But I love the phrase loathsome cretin, and I think I might use that in the future. Regardless how you feel about the whole thing, about David and the adultery and everything, there is one very valid point he made, and I think we can learn from this. A very important lesson. Don't screw around in the workplace, especially with the boss, or if you are the boss, with your subordinates. That is very wrong. I think it's safe to say that I'm not moralizing or being judgmental when I say that it's very unprofessional. You're setting yourself up for a lot of ugliness, sexual harassment suits, just to name one. And remember, we saw how everybody in the office knew and it made everybody uncomfortable. And imagine if you were somebody who worked in that office and you had to deal with that. You had to see that. And if you knew, either Clara or David or a lot of these people knew both, I think that creates an unnecessarily difficult work relationship on everybody. It's just a bad idea. So you're thinking of starting a relationship with somebody that you work with, think long and hard about the consequences, the possible ramifications of that. It later came out that David had told his friends that he felt unappreciated by Clara. And Gail told people in the office that David told her that he only stayed married to Clara because of the kids and the business, and that he told her he loved her, Gail. People thought it was just infatuation and that David liked the attention. Some of David's closest friends confronted him, I guess sort of like an intervention, like, dude, what are you doing? Knock it off, you know, and he supposedly said that he loved Clara and wanted to stay married, but also was reluctant to fire Gail. David's dad, Gerald, told Texas Monthly, quote, "What David did outside his marriage was a tragic mistake, and what Clara did was a tragic mistake. But these were mistakes made by two of the finest people I know. And if God can forgive our sins and our mistakes, then why should we not be able to forgive the sins and mistakes of others? Clara has been a good mother and a good wife, a good person. We hope she'll be able to raise her twin boys in honor of our son, and we will do everything we can to help her." End quote. And as usual, the media was talking to people who knew Clara, David, and Gail. A neighbor of Clara and David said, quote, "She was so nice, I would have never thought she was capable of that. She must have just flipped out at the last minute, as far as I can tell. She truly loved him because everything was David, 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 end quote. Another friend of Clara, who'd known her for 13 years, said, quote, "When I found out, I just sat there saying, no, no, she has completely lost her mind. We were freaked out, like she must have a brain tumor, because this is not Clara," end quote. Friends stayed with her because they were afraid she'd hurt herself, and they claimed the only thing keeping her going was her kids. Lindsay went to Ohio with her mom, where she would stay for good, or at least until she grew up and went to college. The day after she was released on bail, David's body was prepared at the South Park Funeral Home, and it was arranged for Clara and two friends to go see him privately. As soon as she saw her husband's remains, Clara cried, "David," and collapsed, sobbing. His actual funeral was held 2 days later on Saturday, with 300 people present. Most of them were members of Clara and David's church, Shady Crest Baptist. To my surprise, he had an open casket, and you just heard me talk about what condition his body was in after being run over a few times. So that one, I mean, I didn't see it, but quite frankly, it puzzles me. I'm assuming the mortician works some magic. Lindsay did say that he looked unnatural. His coffin lid was decorated with the emblem of the Texas Longhorns, the mascot of the University of Texas, which David had attended for 2 years. So in the days after the murder, Clara called Blue Moon and talked to Bobby Baca, the owner. She asked if there had been a PI there, and Bobby said, yeah, she got it on tape. Clara said, well, where's the tape? Bobby said she already gave it to the police. And this, oh my God, Clara actually had the nerve to ask for a refund for the time she paid the investigators that they weren't following David, meaning because she had already killed him. And Bobby's like, no, ma'am. Clara would later say that her boys would wake up crying and ask for their daddy. And while we're on the topic of the private investigators, this would actually become a big deal and a big part of contention. Remember when somebody called Clara on the evening of the murder and told her that David was in the Hilton on the fourth or sixth floor? Well, the Blue Moon owners, Lucas and Bobby Baca, swore up and down that they didn't tell her his exact location. And you can do with that information what you want. I have a very strong opinion on that, but I'm going to keep it to myself. The day after the crime, according to the book I read, Bobby questioned her husband about what exactly he told Clara on the phone. He said, quote, "I did not give her the name of the hotel, but somehow she knew. I told her they are in a hotel on the fourth or sixth floor. I told her to be patient and she would get a full report the following day." Both Clara and Lindsay testified that Lucas had told her the name of the hotel. So what I'm wondering, if he didn't specify the Hilton, why bother saying fourth or sixth floor? Think about that for a minute. It just doesn't make any sense. Well, yeah, they are in a hotel. They are either on the fourth or sixth floor. Unless you're going to say what hotel, why bother giving the information they're on the fourth or sixth floor? Claire's defense attorney was George Parnum, an experienced attorney who had recently represented another famous defendant, Andrea Yates, who lived nearby. He made sure to have Clara's judge issue an order protecting Gail from Clara, and then to protect Clara, as her friend and former manager, Susan, had told him that Clara had been experiencing suicidal thoughts. So Parnum got Clara into the care of a forensic psychiatrist that he was familiar with. On July 31st, Lindsay's mom filed a lawsuit on her behalf in federal court. It was mainly to freeze David's assets so that Clara wouldn't get them all and they wouldn't be used in her legal defense. Eventually, the money would be put in a trust fund for both Lindsay and her two half-brothers. Lindsay also filed and won a wrongful death lawsuit against Clara and was awarded $2 million for her and the boys. While we're on the subject of lawsuits, because there's always lawsuits, Lindsay's mom filed two more against Blue Moon Detective Agency for allegedly telling Clara David's whereabouts on the night he was killed, and more bizarrely, against Hilton Hotels Corporation for, air quotes, not properly training employees to handle confrontation. So I'm not sure what she expected them to do. They called 911. Two employees were in the parking lot when this occurred because they were witnesses. One approached Clara's car and banged on her hood, possibly putting himself in danger. And I can't find the results of this lawsuit. Clara's trial started on January 23rd, 2003. Considering that the offense had occurred just 6 months before, this is actually a very fast turnaround. It was held in, fittingly enough, Harris County, which was known for its high conviction rates. The trial lasted 3 weeks. Put simply, the defense alleged that Clara hit David by accident, and the prosecution alleged that it was intentional. The prosecution put on 7 eyewitnesses, including Lindsay. 3 were hotel employees, and 3 were tennis players. Remember, I talked about them. They were playing tennis. It was like kind of across the alley. And I said something about, I wonder how much they really could see and hear. Their testimony varied as to how many times Clara had run over David and the exact path of her car. Other witnesses included the police and EMS, medical examiner, and people from Blue Moon. While the ME was showing photos from David's autopsy, which I'm sure were hard to look at, Clara kept sobbing loudly. And the judge, Carol Davies, told her attorney to tell her to knock that shit off or she'll remove her. Or words to that effect, I'm paraphrasing. The prosecution's most damaging witness was by far Lindsay, who was now 17. She had been absolutely traumatized, and sadly she had attempted suicide 4 times. Now remember, she had been in the passenger seat of the car and literally felt the car run over her dad. So her testimony was devastating. Even if you support Clara, I don't think that your heart could not go out to this poor girl. Lindsay said that day, July 24th, about 30 minutes before the fight in the hotel lobby, Clara had said to her, quote, "The way he's been behaving, I could kill him and get away with it," end quote. Something that would stick in your mind if somebody said that to you. Interestingly, she said that Gail had been, quote, "the aggressor" in the affair. She also said that her dad had told her that he was going to, quote, "give Gail up," which she was happy about. She loved Clara. She was like her mom, and she wanted them to stay married. Then the DA, Mia Magnus, led her through what happened in the Hilton parking lot after Clara's fight with Gail. Lindsay said, quote, "she got the keys and we got into the car. She was driving. Then she backed out. She wasn't saying anything. I knew that she was mad. She was red, and she had this evil look on her face. Then she sped up, and a Hilton employee dodged to get out of the way." This would be Garrett Clark. "I was hoping that we were going home, but when she passed the exit, I shouted, 'Stop! Go the other way!'" End quote. I have a feeling Lindsay sensed that something bad was about to happen. She said that then Clara steered the car at Gail's car, which Gail and David were standing beside. And Gail said that she thought Clara was aiming for her. Lindsay said David pushed Gail out of the way. And Clara said, quote, "I'm going to hit him," end quote. She continued, quote, "she circled around and ran over him. She had no expression on her face. And then I felt the bump. I knew it was him. I said, 'You're killing him.' The bump over the median was different from when she was going over my dad. I opened the door so that I could help my dad, but she ran over him again after I told her to stop, end quote. She said that when the car finally stopped, she went around and hit Clara. Then Clara, quote, got out and kneeled down and said, I'm so sorry, it was an accident. She wasn't sorry, she had killed him, end quote. Clara would claim that when she said, I'm going to hit him, that she was referring to Garrett Clark, who was kind of standing in her way, trying to stop her. So there's no question that she said this, but whether she was referring to David or Garrett Clark, nobody will probably ever really know. Then it was the defense's turn. Kind of surprisingly, David's parents and one of his brothers testified on behalf of Clara. David's mom said, quote, Clara included us in everything. She loved David very much, end quote. David's brother, Gerald Jr., said that Clara was, quote, truthful and credible and one of the most law-abiding persons I know, end quote. Then, against her attorney's advice, Clara herself took the stand. Her attorneys put up enlargement of the napkins. Remember the infamous napkins from the restaurant on which Clara had written Clara and Gail and then the things, you know, what I'm talking about. Clara told the jurors how she was devastated when she learned of David's affair and was determined to do whatever it took to save her marriage. During her direct testimony, journalists commented that Clara was, quote, a very compelling witness, likable, with a very nice smile. Of course, she had a very nice smile. She was a fucking dentist. However, after the trial, some jurors commented that Clara seemed phony and her testimony seemed prodded and rehearsed. So we already know that Clara's defense was that she ran over David by accident. When she described the event for the jury, she said that following the fight with Gail, she got into her car and, quote, sat back and laughed. I was in so much pain that I wasn't thinking. She meant emotional pain. Suddenly, I thought about smashing my car against her car, end quote. She insisted that she intended to hit Gail's navigator and didn't see David or Gail. When her attorney asked if she considered that somebody might be injured, she said, quote, no, I saw three people by the driver's door. I saw two people run toward it. He looked so close. I think I closed my eyes. I didn't know it was David, end quote. She recalled Lindsay screaming, stop, stop, and said that after getting out of the car, she, quote, saw David, and I couldn't understand what he was doing there. I had just seen him running. I said, David, please talk to me. His eyes were halfway open. His mouth was halfway open. I thought he was coming in and out of consciousness. I felt his heart on his chest, and it was very fast. He was breathing. I saw a man behind me. Everything was in slow motion, end quote. Remember that for later. Then, under cross-examination, she started to get a little bit emotional, kind of losing her grip on herself, I think. She said, quote, I never saw hitting him. I never saw running over him, end quote. And the way you can tell I think she was losing her composure is her perfect English kind of slipped and she was using improper grammar. Remember, English was not her first language. In his closing argument, Clara's attorney, George Parnum, basically blames everything on Gail, calling her a homewrecker. And whatever you want to think about Gail, regardless, she wasn't driving the car. So that, I think, was a little bit tactless. In her closing argument, the DA, Mia Magnus, cried when she talked about Lindsay witnessing her dad's death. She said that David was, quote, dying on the pavement, drowning in his own blood while his daughter was watching, end quote. The jury of nine women and three men deliberated for 7 hours. They asked for one part of Clara's testimony to be read back, and it was the part where she said that while she was driving at David and Gail, she, quote, was trying to separate them, end quote, and not hurt them. Texas has something called the sudden passion defense. And it's basically the theory that a reasonable person can be so provoked to rage that their mind is incapable of clear thought. Included in this is whether or not Clara had time to cool down between the time she saw David and Gail get off the elevator and the time she killed David. Apparently, the jury had difficulty agreeing on whether Clara did or didn't have sufficient time to cool down. And I could see this being very hard. Like, how do you know? How can you judge about somebody else whether or not they've had sufficient time to cool down about something? Now, if it was like a week, okay. But the time between when she saw them get off the elevator and the time she hit him with her car, I'm thinking the maximum amount of time would have been like 15 minutes. And it was up to the jury to decide whether or not that was enough time for her to calm herself down. They found her guilty of murder. There's no like first degree, second degree. It's just plain murder. And gave her the stiffest sentence possible with the sudden passion provision, which was 20 years and a $10,000 fine. Clara collapsed after hearing the sentence and had to be picked up off the floor by the bailiffs before being led away. She served her time at the maximum security Mountain View unit of the Texas Department of Corrections in Gatesville. And we know that Oprah came there to interview her in 2005. She did discuss the actual crime with Oprah, but I'm going to save that for psychology. Oprah invited Lindsay to be interviewed, but Lindsay declined, sending this statement, quote, "From the day this event occurred, I've tried to avoid doing anything to commercialize or promote the story of my dad's tragic murder. The person who murdered my dad, unfortunately, has not exercised the same restraint. She's appeared in print and on TV to persuade the viewers that she's actually the victim. But she is no victim. What she did was the ultimate act of selfishness, caring only about obtaining revenge and thinking not one bit about how her horrible act was going to affect me or my brothers. Anyone who shared my ride in the car that evening, seeing my dad's face as he was about to be hit, and experience the horrible feeling of the car bumping over his body, would understand that this murderess deserves no sympathy," end quote. As far as I know, Lindsay doesn't talk to Clara. The same year, 2005, Ruth Rendon of the Houston Chronicle also interviewed Clara in prison. So I want to tell you about this interview. Clara said that when her kids visited her up to 3 times a month, one time she asked them, "Do you know what happened to Daddy?" They said, "Yes, a car hit him." So Clara said, "That was me." And she demonstrated with blocks, you know, blocks they had to play with. One of the kids said, quote, "I don't want to hear anymore." All three of them were crying and hugging. Clara said, "Do you forgive me?" And they said, "Yes, Mama." So after a bitter custody battle between Clara and her in-laws, the judge granted her joint custody of the kids with their family friends, the Joneses, in September 2003. Supposedly, the boys were happy and well-adjusted there, and according to Clara, ran to her with open arms when they came to visit. The boys' psychologist found them suffering from depression and separation anxiety, which is, of course, is no surprise. And she said that this psychologist told her not to cry in front of them. I don't really know why, but I can see her getting emotional when they come to see her. She got visits from other family and friends, And she was happy about her job there, which was converting textbooks into Braille. She said the work, quote, is the best thing that is happening in this place. I got into it about a year ago, and I'm about to get my certification to become a Braille transcriber. I didn't know how important that was until I got into it seriously. We really love the profession because we know that we're doing something good for the blind kids in the state of Texas, end quote. She likes the fact that when she transcribes school books on history, government, science, math, and music, she's also learning too. She was also taking a psychology class, and she said, quote, I have tried to keep my schedule pretty busy. In my cell, I don't have much time. Studying Braille, studying psychology, writing letters, end quote. Her day started at 3 a.m. She had breakfast at 3:30, and at 4:30 stood in line to pick up her daily clothes and towel. She got clean sheets once a week. And for the most part, she said she felt safe and comfortable. And interestingly, she was somewhat of a celebrity there. And she shared this story that the warden kind of told her privately, and I don't have the exact quote, so I'm just going to paraphrase this. The warden didn't say like, oh, I think it's really cool what you did, or I admire you, or it was something along those lines like, you know, I don't blame you for what you did, or something to that effect. And Clara was asked if she wanted to block the Lifetime movie that was going to be made about her. I'll discuss that later. She said, no, I want to see what they say about me. And after she saw the movie, Warden Audrey Smith asked her what she thought. And Clara said, quote, I never wore that black leather outfit, end quote. She was denied parole twice before she was finally granted parole on May 11th, 2018, at age 60. And she was all smiles as she walked out of prison to be picked up by friends. Her parole period ended last February, so she is what you call off paper. A former neighbor of hers said, quote, I think she served her time and realized what she did was wrong, end quote. Before we get into psychology, I have some statistics on married people who hire PIs. Bobby Newman of ACTA Investigations Incorporated said that in 30 years, he never saw an investigation of a suspected adulterer turned dangerous. Attorney Ken Raggio, who practices family law, said that lots of couples cheat and then hire private investigators. Texas has what's called a fault divorce law, meaning that you can blame somebody for a divorce. You know, it's his fault or it's her fault on grounds of cruel treatment, abandonment, adultery, addiction. So I think that what that makes people do is want to seek out evidence of these things, especially the adultery. So I think that that's probably why PIs that follow husbands and wives are more popular in Texas and whatever other states, I don't know what they are, have this fault divorce law. And PIs are supposed to keep the client or do their best to keep the client away from the scene of the investigation, meaning, as you could probably tell, not telling them that, oh, your husband is in the Hilton room, whatever, or floor, whatever. This case has been seen a lot in the media. It was on the show Snapped in 2004, Deadly Women in 2010, and there was a Lifetime original movie made about it called Suburban Madness. I did not see any of these, but from what I understand about the Lifetime movie, it was more about, I vaguely alluded to this earlier, how in this one community, this Blue Moon investigation actually had several different clients who were like intertwined with each other. There was Claire and David, and there was Gail and her husband who Remember, Gail was supposedly having a lesbian affair with her friend Julie, and they were following these people. It was a mess. It was ridiculous. But supposedly the movie is more about all of these people than focusing on Claire and David. A couple studies I found. One, a sociological study, showed that the more a man is financially dependent on his wife, the higher the chance that he would cheat because he may feel emasculated. And I think this pertained to Claire and David as far as who made more money. They were, I don't know, probably equal, but I think without both of them working, that they couldn't afford the lifestyle, the mansion and the pool and whatever else they had. Another study found that women with higher body dissatisfaction tend to blame the mistress more than their husband in the case of an affair. And this really fits here because remember the napkins, what Clara wrote about comparing herself to Gail, and her husband was like, oh, well, you're big. She's small and petite, and she has big boobs. And she went about, actually put a deposit on for cosmetic surgery. Plus, she had been in that beauty pageant, which kind of indicates, at least to me, that she was interested in physical beauty, or that physical beauty was something important to her. So the killing of a husband is called mariticide, literally the murder of a spouse, but has come to mean the murder of the husband, usually by his wife. It's also a term used in killing one's boyfriend. And nowadays, it's kind of a gender-neutral term, meaning the killing of a spouse or significant other. According to the CDC, Center for Disease Control, mariticide accounts for 30% of the total spouse murders in the U.S. So there's still way more husbands who kill their wives. Another study found that the main causes of mariticide are frustration, alcohol abuse, mental illness, and socioeconomic hardship. For some couples, the problem starts with domestic violence and then escalates to one of them killing the other one. With others, such as this one, there's no warning or no previous pattern of abuse. I guess you could maybe term what David was doing to Clara emotional abuse. Like, I found a girlfriend and she has bigger boobs than you. To me, that's emotionally abusive. I could be wrong. I don't know. But one of the major causes, to probably nobody's surprise, of mariticide is jealousy. It causes anger and anxiety, damages the relationship. Professor Robert Leahy at Weill Cornell University Medical College said that jealous men were more likely to kill their wives, while jealous women were more likely to kill themselves and or the kids. And some other reasons for mariticide would be for financial benefit, like insurance money. I don't think we have to think too hard to figure out which of the seven FBI categories of motives this one fits into. It's obviously jealousy. And as far as psychology, my disclaimer, I'm not a mental health professional. I've never met Clara. I cannot diagnose her or anybody else. We're just going to talk about some things about her and possibly what could be going on. Now, remember when at her trial she said that she didn't recall hitting David and she was not aware of running him over? She told Oprah in 2005 that her goal was to stop Gail's car from taking David, which of course doesn't make any logical sense, but she claims to have no clear memory of the event. And she said she froze and was trying to get out of the parking lot. She said, quote, "I didn't have rational thinking at the moment. I was like in a slow motion," end quote. Then she said, quote, "I saw myself as I was in a tunnel vision and foggy around, end quote. This sounds to me like something called dissociation. Have you ever heard of this? It's a psychological thing that happens. It's happened to me. Probably a lot of you have experienced this. It's defined as a sense of disconnect, like a break in how your mind handles information. You can feel disconnected from your thoughts, feelings, memories, and surroundings. It can affect your perception of time. A lot of people use that phrase, like she did, everything was in slow motion or time stopped. You know how I like to try to see if I can apply anything to my own life to try to understand what people were going through? And I have a perfect memory of time stopping, and I'll try to make it as short as I can. I had been at my job as a probation officer, I don't know, over a year, and me and like 10 other people who were hired around the same time were called down to the director's office, and we were told that we were getting laid off. Spoiler alert, we didn't. But I can remember so clearly, it was literally like time stopped. Like we were all frozen. And I remember looking around, everybody's expressions, everybody just like had their mouths open, like what? The clock on the director's desk was ticking. Like it was so quiet in there. You just hear this tick, tick. And it was so like we were all just frozen there. And because of that was a traumatic incident for us. And one cause of dissociation is trauma. Something called peritraumatic dissociation occurs during the time of a trauma when the mind uses it to protect you from the experience. So when Clara says that she doesn't have a memory of running David over, she may very well be telling the truth, that her brain is protecting her from that traumatic memory. Other causes of dissociation are hypnosis, meditation, certain drugs, more often the psychedelic drugs like LSD, shrooms, stuff that I would never, ever mess with for like any amount of money. Dissociation, like I described, happened to me and probably has happened to a lot of you, is different from dissociative disorders. These are also associated with trauma. And one example is DID, dissociative identity disorder, used to be called multiple personality disorders. So it's just a way that the brain protects itself from something bad. And we had some quotes from people who say, Clara never did anything like this, was never violent, and how shocked everybody was. But Lindsay said that she sometimes was hot-tempered and would act out, which I think means like maybe throw a fit or a tantrum if she didn't get her way. But a lot of people are hot-tempered. A lot of people have a fit or get upset if they don't have their way. And you would never expect them to do what she did. So I think it's safe to say that nobody saw this coming. This episode is dedicated to Lindsay and her brothers. I hope they're doing okay. They went through something awful that no kids, especially Lindsay, no kid should, or nobody should ever have to experience something like that. So I really hope that they're doing well now. Next week is kind of a request, and I don't want to say what it is because I'm still not sure that I can find enough information on it. There's no book or anything like that. It's information is, for me, for what I'm used to, a little bit scarce. So I'm not promising that I can pull it off. But if I can, it's what you would call a lighter episode, like nobody gets hurt. So it'll definitely be interesting. Before we go, let's hear from my friend Jay of Fright Flick FMK.
Do you like scary movies?
If your answer is yes, then you got to check out my show, Fright Flick FMK. My name's Jay, and along with my co-host, Gentleman and Jack, I watch and discuss horror movies and tell you what I think about them, new or old, mainstream or underground. No horror flick is safe from my warped opinion. So listen to Fright Flick FMK now. It's on all major podcast platforms and YouTube. Also, be sure to follow the show on TikTok and Instagram. But be warned, this promo is the longest amount of time you'll hear me talk without swearing or cracking an offensive joke.